Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update on Fridays here at JMAM. Good morning, Mr. Honlein.
Good morning, Nachum.
Getting ready for the holiday, huh?
Happy Matzahs and looking forward to being with the Chevra.
Oh, California?
Arizona.
Oh, in Arizona?
Right. We go to the desert to relive the experience. And you'll see us tramping across the desert just to get the real feeling.
Oh, I didn't realize that was the reason they go to Arizona.
Of course.
That was the reason?
To really feel the yontif.
How many times?
Not just because it's beautiful and all those other things.
How many times will you present over the 8 days? Many?
At least three.
Wow. All on different topics yet?
Because I have to, all the information I would have given on next week's update, I have to give them exclusively.
So that's all exclusive for West Coast folks, huh?
Exclusive to people from all over.
Now you understand.
Not just West Coast.
Now you understand. No, but I'm saying only the people who are there are going to hear it. Now you see why it's so important to go to the right Pesach program, right?
Right.
Oh, yes. All right. It was announced this week by the Conference of Presidents that Richard Stone has been elected chair of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, assumes the position on June the 1st. Malcolm, is Richard Stone a good choice to lead the Conference of Presidents?
Well, in any event, I would have to say yes, because he's been elected. But it's a wonderful choice. He's a remarkable person. He's a professor of law and a venture capitalist, many other things. But most of all, he's the president of the Beis Yosef Yeshivas, which I think is probably the thing that put him over the top. We really had a number of very outstanding candidates. He is the first Orthodox candidate to win in, I think, about 30 years. But that isn't a factor. Once you're chairman, you represent the broad spectrum of Jewish life, and he's been involved with the conference for many years. So it's a very good choice.
I'm just thinking, so would that be Dr. Israel Miller?
Julie Berman.
Oh, Julie Berman. That's 30 years already?
About 30 years.
Yeah. Holy cow, unbelievable. All right, a couple of things. Last week we spent so much time in the first part of the segment in regard to Goldstone. The story doesn't go away, I guess, in a way that's good. There seems to be some confusion in Israel about how to react to all of this and what to demand from whom. Members of Congress have already proposed taking a vote regarding Goldstone and whether it should be, I guess you'd say, whether it should be officially part of the UN report or officially part of the analysis of the cast of Operation Cast Lead. What is it that members of Congress want?
Well, the goal of the congressional resolution, the Senate passed a resolution yesterday, is really to ask for rescission and or rejection. You can't really rescind a report. I guess the Human Rights Council could be mavatalit, could throw it with the hummets and burn it, which is where it really belongs. But if you remember when Zionism Racism was passed, when the resolution is passed, then you need to pass another resolution to kill it. This thing, to the optimal thing, would be a statement that they pass saying, we reject the report now. But the other members of the Goldstone Commission committee, who most of whom were extremely biased and before they started, had long histories of their of the attitude towards Israel, and the Secretary General and the head of the Human Rights Council have all indicated that they are not prepared to move to rescind the report. So this is really now an opportunity to put the markers down to say that more and more countries, more and more people would oppose the report, recognize his partial mea culpa as clear evidence of the falsity of the report as he acknowledges it, and he also acknowledges that Israel can't get a fair hearing at the Human Rights Council, which one need only look at their voting record, and that 80% of their country-specific resolutions deal with Israel.
All right, so just like those members of Congress, in terms of Israel and its reaction to all this, they also basically could just go for, rescinding it and taking, an active role in the UN to see what officially could be done, to come up with a new resolution, et cetera. Like, is there anything else we need to know about what goes on behind the scenes now that the Goldstone report has been, exposed, so to speak?
Yes, that the danger still is that they will use this to go to the International Criminal Court or International Court of Justice against Israel. That's what the Palestinians have indicated they still plan to do. And that unless there is this repudiation of the report, then they can say, well, Goldstone was under pressure, as they say, from the Zionists, from the United States, from all sorts of nefarious sources, rather than acknowledging that his conscience caught up with him and that he, you know, realized that the damage the report did, and that damage can't be undone.
Right.
It is a fact.
So, but officially on paper, then what you're saying is it's so vital to actually do something officially. It's important to somehow, again, like you said, you can't get it undone, but to officially get it either wiped out or altered.
That's right, is to try and establish a clear record that it can't be the basis for further action. And if we could just hear more from the Europeans and others, like the United States came out about the report, that would have at least the moral suasion, even if it's not a legal basis.
Right. The enemy will now use this opportunity. We know that there's been an effort in the UN to, we've been discussing this, to declare Palestine as a state. This will only help that effort, right? The more things swing now toward Israel, the more of a case Arab League and people like them will have to try to get that push through.
That is right. It contributes to the climate. We are seeing this increasing pressure towards what we call UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. It is a very serious matter. We had a meeting at the conference this week of a special committee we formed on this, and the room was overflowing with people because they understand the seriousness of this, and we've been working for many months on it, trying to get the various parties to rescind or oppose this move. Unfortunately, you see the flirtations by the Europeans with it. You see, we've discussed how the South American countries have come out for it, and there are two phases. One is at the Security Council, where the United States, we believe, would veto it, the move. But they would go then to the General Assembly, where there's an automatic majority, just a non-aligned movement headed by Iran, would give him the votes. But if you keep the votes down to a minimum level, even if it passes, it doesn't give it the authority, certainly not the moral authority, but the General Assembly can't declare a state. And, you know, in 1988, the Palestinian National Council issued a Declaration of Independence. And it doesn't change things. And the General Assembly then, with 110 votes or 120 votes, endorsed it. It doesn't create borders. It doesn't necessarily change things on the ground. It does create, as you said earlier, this climate of change, a perception that gives them a grounds to, let's say, go to the international courts and say, we have this declaration from the General Assembly. We ought to be able to set our borders. We are able to bring charges of war crimes, which only states can do.
Right. And the other thing is that and it's so hard to focus on what might happen afterwards because, frankly, you know, all of us are focused on making sure it doesn't happen, or at least we say we are. But once if this does happen, if a unilateral declaration does take place in the United Nations, then Israel could be cited, quote unquote, and I'm careful the way I'm using this, occupying another member state.
That is right, and you're focusing on an important thing, which we are looking at, and that is the day after, regardless of the outcome, either outcome. But knowing that you can always get this automatic majority means that we have to be prepared the day after for what the implications. It doesn't legally create that circumstance, but the Palestinians will so say, and we have seen more and more statements being issued. We've seen some of the comments from the international community on this, where you see the impact, even short of the full recognition of the state, that the Security Council has to do.
The European Union and some of the countries that are active when it comes to the PA, are they putting their money where their mouth is? Because I saw an item this week that the Palestinian Prime Minister Fayyad actually asked representatives in Brussels for $5 billion to invest in the launching of a Palestinian state.
They have asked for, he has asked for assistance, and they declared in Europe the donors conference, which is the people who give the money to the Palestinians. Europe alone is giving them $463 million, I think. that they called it the birth certificate for the Palestinian state, because they came out with a report saying that they've crossed the threshold by which they could establish the basis, the foundation for a state, meaning that they've created the internal institutions. And that declaration then is being taken by Fayyad, and that was the context in which he made his comment.
How much money is required to start a state? Like, what's
$1.75?
I mean, I was just going to say, like, what's the budget? Isn't the declaration one of those, you know, priceless items that you don't really need a cash investment for?
Well, first of all, they're surviving on foreign aid, and that's one of the issues that is raised: is how do you declare a state that really is dependent upon the income? The Europeans gave recognition now and duty-free status to agricultural imports from the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, others have tried to create the duty-free arrangements. And their economic growth was 9%, which is the best, highest in the world, probably. But it's not a real 9%. And they get the highest level of per capita of aid of anybody in the world. So the economy is really not a self-sustaining and established
not,
one.
Not a large tax base, huh?
I wouldn't say. I don't know if anybody pays tax.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Well, it's the holiday of freedom beginning Monday night. Got to turn our
It's everybody's definition of freedom depends on where you're coming from, you know.
Yeah, we know what the Shalit family's definition of freedom is, and I want to talk about that for a minute. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmn.org. I'm sure part of your message in terms of observing Pesach these days would be that when we sit down Monday night, there are Jews around the world who are in very difficult circumstances. Obviously, Gilad Shalit is one of them. The Israeli government special negotiator for the release of Shalit announced his departure yesterday. He was appointed in 2009 by Prime Minister Netanyahu to be the chief negotiator for Shalit's release. He explained when he took over the job, he told Netanyahu that because of family obligations, he can only accept the responsibility for 2 years. And he said he would stay on until the successor was found. He was pretty positive in regard to his attitude toward the Netanyahu government, maybe he had no choice, when he announced his resignation or that he was leaving. Is there anything at this point, as we get to Erev Pesach, to think differently in regard to the future of Gilad Shalit?
Well, I wish I could say that we have some positive signs. You know, Hamas continues to play their inhumane, barbaric role, as in the past, in regard to Shalit.
There was a rumor that a letter from him was coming out or something, or recording?
A video. Right. And the Hamas, again, plays with that to raise hopes and to toy with the families and the emotions of people. I think what you will find out, the reference that the negotiator made, and I've met him and worked with him, is that Netanyahu offered an even better deal than Olmert did to Hamas to get him out, and he and they rejected it. So the effort has been ongoing and constant. I can tell you that there isn't a meeting that the representatives of Israel or we have or others with the U.S. officials, U.N. officials, everybody, that we don't raise it. And Europeans actually on this have been trying as well. You know, obviously Hamas uses this as a bargaining chip and thinks it protects them from an all-out bombing perhaps or whatever else these warped minds conceive. But it's really regrettable that another Pesach and he's still in this solitary confinement, unable to see his family, communicate with anybody, the violation of all the Geneva Conventions, but I guess we can't get UN to recognize that.
We know some of the things that have happened on Pesach. I refer obviously most notably recently to 2002. Is Israel preparing any differently this week than normal before a big holiday, or basically you would say that it seems, at least from the reports, that it's a standard operating procedure as of now?
Well, it's not standard in the sense that you had the rockets in the south and that Israel has to be on alert. Right now there is a ceasefire, but every time Hamas gets hit back, you know, it's like a child starts a fight and then, you know, wants to stop it when they start getting beaten up.
Right.
And the attack on the bus was, of course, a major watershed event. It wasn't just another event because they could see it was a bus. Hundreds of rockets that have fallen just this year. Also, we don't know what Iran's agenda is. You know, Iran holds the trigger, whether when it comes to Hamas and Hezbollah. You have two very dynamic situations, especially in Lebanon. If the Hariri report comes out, the special tribunal report, it's expected that Hezbollah, if named, has threatened to do all sorts of things. You have a situation in Syria with this Friday of Perseverance, with the demonstration spreading to other cities.
You know, I have to ask you about that as you bring it up. Why does it seem to me that Syria is so different than what the other countries in the Middle East have gone through, those that have seen, you know, the revolutionary activities over the last few months? Why does it seem that Syria has less control or is able to hold on better to the control that they have compared to some of the other governments?
Well, it's first of all, you don't have the international community intervening. Second of all, this government, the Assad government, has no choice. Because for them, it's not a question of turning it over to the army. It's not a question a national army, because essentially all the key positions are occupied by the Alawites. They lose control. They know they're finished. They will either be killed or all imprisoned or driven out or whatever.
So then the flip side, why aren't the protests working as well as they did in Egypt, for instance?
Because they're following the Russian, the Iranian model, maybe the Russian model in Chechnya, but the Iranian model, which is to crush it and to keep the opposition down.
Which Egypt couldn't do because of world detention.
It couldn't do because of world detention and because they didn't act, and this thing then...
Right, they didn't act quickly enough.
...loaded into a huge flame that they couldn't contain and that they had to confront. Then you also had a national army in Egypt which could step in, and which, when they refused to fire on the demonstrators, that was the turning point. Here the army is, and in fact, they sent in these, they're called the Ghosts, which is a special police run by Assad's brother, who kills soldiers who refuse to shoot at the demonstrators.
So they're not even, that's the difference, because Egypt had to keep this air on that they're a democracy, that they are a more open society, that they're not willing to kill people who refuse to serve, things like that. In Syria, that's not a problem. They have to hold on at whatever cost.
Well, they weren't a democracy before.
Yeah, but they gave that impression that they were more of a democratic government, so to speak.
Right. And don't forget, in Egypt, you also had, even if you had a million people there, that's less than 1% of the about 1% of the population.
Syria.
And I think that in the mistakes in Egypt, for instance, were Mubarak trying to put his son in power, doing other things, where if they had responded differently, and if they had come down and crushed it in the first day, they might have survived.
Right.
In Syria, the situation is different. The Alawites have no option, and there is total control over the apparatuses of government by he and his allies.
So it's as rough to revolt in Syria as it is in Iran?
Yes. I think that, and they're using model, and we believe that Iran, and you saw Secretary Gates indicated that they believe that Iran is involved in the Bahrain and in Yemen. Big surprise. If they had listened to the show, they would have known it a long time
That's
ago.
That's correct.
But also in Syria, we know that they provided bulletproof vests and other stuff to them. They're also worried about spillover. They're worried about Assad falling and a Sunni government coming to power that might be hostile to them. Hezbollah, we know, has gotten involved or been reported to have been involved in fighting some of the demonstrations. The Syrians deny that Iran was involved. Their foreign ministers spoke about it. Others have spoken about it. Assad released those who had been arrested. There were demonstrations, big ones, all over the country by women to release those who had been arrested, their husbands and others. And yesterday he released it. He announced a new government, which is essentially a reflection of the old government. You know, those are token gestures, but the government here really depends on Assad, his brother and the family, and still the same controlling forces. And then Iran also worries about its internal situation. If people see that they can get away with it in Syria, they have a particular problem now, you know, where natural gas, they removed the subsidy, so natural gas has gone up 10 times the price, and people are beginning to really feel the impact in the cost of gas for cars, and that was the reason for a lot of the demonstrations that started in North Africa, was the price of food, price of gas, price of other things. So we're beginning to see, you know, we've seen some reaction already in Iran regarding this.
Yeah, but there were other economic considerations in Iran a year or two ago already.
there were, and they rescinded then the measures, and they also gave cash handouts to people who couldn't afford it, they said, and tried to subsidize the cost of and the impact. In Syria, by the way, one of the other factors was the fact that this has spread to other cities like Aleppo, where in the past you had the Muslim Brotherhood. When his father, Assad's father, killed tens of thousands of people in Hama, the Muslim Brotherhood was also fought out in Aleppo. And in Latakia, where you often had tensions between Sunni and Alawite, and that's why the military was deployed to these coastal cities like Latakia, which is a port, to try and quell these quell the demonstrations. Iran also suffered a blast that they admitted was sabotage near Qom of the main energy pipeline, and they said that there's been a series of mysterious blasts and
nobody's taking credit for it.
And nobody has taken credit, exactly.
You
were not there, right?
I was not there, but maybe I'm related to someone who was. listen, I don't know if this was a sarcastic response on your part or not, but you'll tell me if it was. And you also have to explain to me the premise here. The Arab League wants a no-fly zone over Gaza. I know you reacted by saying there should be a no-fly zone for all the rockets that come out of Gaza to Israel, and you'll tell me the level of sarcasm that included. But what's with the Arab League's premise? Why would they want to impose one over Gaza?
Well, this was Amri Moussa, who's the Secretary General of the Arab League and also the leading candidate now to be president of Egypt, who by the way, offered assurances this week that the Muslim Brotherhood won't take over and won't have power. There are more than 20 candidates, by the way, now for the presidency of Egypt, which means that the democratic forces, those young people, are dividing the vote and going to undermine their ability to impact.
To make a difference.
Get back to the Arab League thing. Yeah. The no-fly zone was an effort on their part to try to get the Security Council to do what they did in Libya, to bar Israeli planes from being able to strike back at the terrorists and to try to get international intervention that would essentially strip Israel of the ability to defend itself. I'm sure that the Security Council, there would have been vetoes of it. I don't think there was any support. I think it was a PR move on his part, but the Arab League calling for it already gives you a block of votes, and so that became an issue. And what my response was, which was a bit of sarcasm, but it was to make a point that if you're talking about a no-fly zone that the UN should be imposing, it's against terrorists sending rockets across the borders of Israel into civilian populations.
That's what should be... not flying out of Gaza. I don't know if you agree or disagree about the attention level that this story in California has gotten, but bottom line is, after the police have investigated, someone did try to burn down a shul in California, right?
There was an attempt to bomb a shul. There was
to bomb a shul,
an incendiary device. There was an attempt yesterday of a fire in a shul that was, let's say, of suspicious nature and more. But I don't think that the guy who was involved is somebody who's hung around synagogues. He I think, probably very troubled. We don't know yet all the details and circumstances, but he has been arrested. He was arrested in Ohio, and they've traced evidence to indicate that he was involved.
DNC chair, the brand new one, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Any reaction to her ascension to this title?
Well, it's usually given to people who are good fundraisers, and obviously she is, and she's an articulate, attractive person. I know there are many in the community who have problems that, that she's left of center and right of center, but amongst her peers, she obviously has broad-based support.
And will enjoy that support as the campaign builds up.
Well, I think one of the problems that the Democrats have been saying, and I can only indicate what I've heard, is that the Jewish donors have been holding back, maybe because of the economy, maybe because of disaffection from the administration or disaffection from politics in general. So perhaps having somebody like her, they feel, would help.
And I apologize for rushing things this morning because Rabbi Yudin is standing by with the Shabbos HaGadol radio drusha. But Malcolm, some listeners asked about this, and I neglected to ask it last week, and I've been urged to ask yet again. You've been outspoken about Al Sharpton, and you witnessed the President of the United States have a pretty friendly meeting with him in New York very recently. Any comment about that?
Well, for us, it's a domestic affair and not the kind of thing that we would necessarily issue a statement about. And Sharpton has, I guess, changed his tone somewhat over the years as he's gotten older. And the fact that the President of the United States would come to New York, that's a very significant move. It's not something he does regularly, especially for the anniversary of an organization about which many people had questions. So I know that many commentators and others have made reference to it.
Pesach message for us. Anything you want to tell us? We'll speak again 2 weeks from today, but anything you want to tell us as we sit down with our children and grandchildren for the Seder this coming Monday night?
Well, the first thing I think is that we shouldn't take freedom for granted. When you see the demonstrations in countries where no one would have predicted it, it reminds us of the value of freedom and that people are willing to die for freedom, that the Seder, which reminds us of our struggle for freedom, but it's not just physical freedom. It doesn't mean just not being in jail or not being under an oppressive regime. But for us, freedom has much greater implications. And number one, we should be thinking of Gilad Shalit, and every family at the Seder should remember him and the other MIAs whose families have suffered so much for doing nothing but wanting to have a free Jewish state. And think of the 20,000 people who gave their lives defending it, men and women in Israel, who gave so much. And to remember that the challenges are there in every generation. I'm going to the March of the Living and speaking at the March of the Living after Pesach. And, you know, it makes you think to what the events of 70 years ago and the warnings when we see some of the same messages emerging today. We didn't have a chance to get into some of the reports about the campus anti-Semitism, about, you know, the BDS developments over the last days, some of the questions about imposing things on Israel coming from all sorts of different sources, the Turks announcing they're going to go ahead with the flotilla, some of the other developments which are almost overwhelming. And I think people have to sit back. You know, one of the things about the Seder is you can't think about it just about an event that took place thousands of years ago. It's like the reading of the Megillah. Right. If you don't understand its contemporary importance, you miss the point.
Malcolm, excellent as usual. Have a great Yontif. We speak 2 weeks from today. Our best regards to everybody in Arizona.
Certainly.
Malcolm Hohenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.